Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is John Horning, Executive Director of the Wild Earth Guardians. I absolutely love the mission statement for Wild Earth Guardians. Among other things, it says, "We believe in nature's right to exist and thrive. We act on this belief with compassion and courage by preserving the wild world. We defend wildness, empower life, end injustice, and stand for healthy, sustainable ecosystems and human communities. We embrace conflict and cooperate without compromising our values. We execute the campaign strategically and decisively. We mobilize, inform, and inspire others, and we work to heal wounded landscapes. Our enduring and fierce advocacy leads us to success. We are a force for nature." Part of John's bio says, quote, "He is grateful to live in New Mexico and feels privileged to be a voice for the voiceless." And so really my first question or comment or something is that one of the things I love so much about your organization is how you are explicitly biocentric. So would you like to talk about that for a little while?
Yeah. You know, it is a core Guardian value. It has been from the very beginning. We celebrate our 25th anniversary as an organization this coming year, and we started as we have similar roots to some of your roots, Derek. We started as a group fighting old growth, ancient forests, logging timber sales by the Forest Service. And, you know, we've just always believed that species and places have an intrinsic right to exist. It's not about our needs or our benefits, though we're happy to benefit from the beauty of wild nature and the joy and grace of experiencing wild animals. But we don't believe that's why we do the work we do. We do the work because we believe wild nature has this intrinsic right to exist. Now, the other thing that I would say is that Guardians believe that conflict is an essential part of any social change strategy. And it's also mentioned there in that mission statement that we are not afraid of conflict. And I think it's something that I find troubling in this day and age, that so many social change movements are reluctant to engage in conflict in all of its various forms. But I think it was Frederick Douglass who said, "Power concedes nothing without a struggle." And in all of our campaigns and work, part of what we are doing is trying to shift power. And when you're shifting power, it's going to be a struggle, and conflict is, to me, an inevitable part of that struggle.
So can you tell me about some of the... we can call them conflicts, we can call them projects. So here's the question is, so can you tell me about some of your projects leading up to... one of the things I wanted to talk about was the whole delisting of the wolf. So can you sort of talk about some of your projects in general and then angle over toward wolves?
Sure. Well, one of the probably landmark events that Guardians is proud of is a settlement agreement that we reached with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service 2 years ago. And the settlement agreement was the result of about a dozen different lawsuits, and it addressed what we call the Endangered Species Act listing logjam. The background briefly is that for years and years under the Bush administration, this is the George W. Bush administration, and even towards the tail end of the Clinton administration and at the beginning of the Obama administration, many imperiled species that deserved the safety net that is the Endangered Species Act were being deprived of that safety net by being relegated to what we call regulatory purgatory. It's a specific designation that the Fish and Wildlife Service uses called warranted but precluded. It's a regulatory term. What it means is you're screwed as an imperiled species because you're not getting the attention you need. So we brought this series
of laws. So you can have some species of slender salamander, or, you know, name some species in a second. So you can have some species that is warranted, that the science says that this creature is in danger of going extinct, but they're not going to do anything about it. Is that basically what that means?
Yes. Yep. That's exactly what it means. And so the regulatory term of art is this warranted but precluded. What the agency ended up doing is using that provision of the Endangered Species Act to relegate almost 300 species to this purgatory of non-protection, even though, as you noted, the science and the scientists had already determined that they were in critical danger of extinction and needed the Endangered Species Act. So we brought a series of lawsuits in different forums and venues all across the country that ultimately forced the Fish and Wildlife Service under the Obama administration just over 2 years ago to agree to end that Endangered Species Act listing backlog. And so ultimately, there will be over 1,000 different species that will get the attention that they deserve, and there will be about 300 different species that will ultimately be listed under the Endangered Species Act. Some of them, like the Haynes Mountain salamander, whose critical habitat was just designated today and who was listed over a month ago, had been waiting for federal protection for 3 decades. And so it was a long-standing dysfunction on the part of the Department of Interior that basically was very widespread. These species are local, rare endemics like the Haynes Mountain salamander, and they're wide-ranging political hot potatoes like the greater sage grouse. So our listing agreement broke that backlog. And in the last 2 years since our settlement, about 110, slightly more than 110 species have been listed, and the most recent of which was this Haynes Mountain salamander, which exists in the Haynes Mountains just to the west of Santa Fe. So we're extremely proud of the fact that our legal efforts and our pushing and prodding against the agency in all of its forms, letters to the editor, editorials, a little bit of lobbying and a lot of grassroots pressure and a lot of legal pressure resulted in this major shift in policy that has resulted in more species being listed, which, you know, the act can't work unless species are listed. So it's the first step in what we hope is a long process towards recovery for a lot of these rare and critically endangered plants and animals.
So something that's been in the news a lot lately, it's been in the activist news a lot lately, has to do with delisting of wolves and active wolf hunts. I believe there's an active wolf hunt going on right now in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk a little bit about well, actually before that, or maybe somehow included in this, is also the question of the wolves in New Mexico. But can you talk about wolves?
Sure. Well, you know, the landscape for wolf recovery is fairly bleak at the moment, unfortunately. And tonight, just coincidentally, there's a hearing that the Fish and Wildlife Service is hosting. And the Fish and Wildlife Service, of course, is the federal agency under the Department of Interior that is responsible for recovering imperiled species from bats and butterflies to wolves and other native carnivores. the Mexican gray wolf is one of three different species that occur in the States that is critically endangered. There are only 75 Mexican gray wolves that exist in the wilds of southwestern New Mexico and southeastern Arizona. It's a deeply flawed recovery program. The only reason that the Fish and Wildlife Service isn't abandoning the recovery effort here, as it is everywhere else, which I'll get to in a moment, is that they've failed so miserably over the last 15 years, and they've hamstrung the program through poor, just an absence of vision and leadership. And so, as I mentioned, there are only 75 wolves in an area that could support, say, 400 wolves. I want to add one, maybe just one other thing for now about this region and this species of wolves, because it's near and dear to my heart. Not many people know Aldo Leopold, but Aldo Leopold is an icon in the conservation movement for two separate reasons. Well, for many reasons, but they're kind of two pillars of the Leopold legacy. Leopold came to New Mexico in 1911 as a young Yale School of Forestry trained conservationist, and within a short time he fell in love with the greater Gila bioregion, just was enchanted by the beautiful old growth yellow-bellied ponderosa pines and the canyons. And just, it's if you've never been to southwestern New Mexico, I say put it on your bucket list. And so Leopold, basically, the two cornerstones of his legacy are wolves and wilderness. In 1924, he convinced the Forest Service to designate administratively America's first wilderness, and that is the Gila Wilderness. He also ultimately had his own ecological epiphany about the role and importance of wolves. And though early in his life, as he called it, he had trigger itch and wanted to kill wolves, he later had tremendous regret about, from both an ecological and an ethical perspective, about the importance of wolves on the landscape. So because of Leopold and his importance in our region and his importance to kind of a modern understanding of wolves, for us, the greater Gila bioregion is really an important campaign, and we have, we call it our Leopold's Legacy campaign, where we're trying to basically retire grazing allotments that ranchers have that are in high conflict, chronic conflict between wolves and the ranchers' cattle. And we're also trying to expand wilderness, building off of America's first wilderness. There's about 2.2 million acres of land within the greater Gila that could be designated as wilderness. That's wild, roadless, but still unprotected. And so we want to make the greater Gila a crown jewel of conservation. And we want to do it for a lot of reasons, but one of them, returning to the subject of wolves, is we feel like the only way to secure recovery of Mexican wolves in the Southwest is to make the greater Gila a stronghold. And we think the way to do that is to retire these grazing allotments and to expand the protected landscape by designating lands as wilderness. So that's one piece of the wolf fabric in the country. We've got a long way to go, but at least wolves are not being delisted. As we go north, we've had all sorts of political meddling of wolves, where wolves have been congressionally delisted. There was no scientific case for the delisting of wolves, and yet Congress intervened, and the Obama administration blessed this disastrous decision by Congress to override the Endangered Species Act. It's really the first time in the history of the Endangered Species Act that politics trumped the administrative process. And as a result, wolves were delisted under the Endangered Species Act in both Montana and Idaho. And since then, there have been over 1,500 wolves that have been killed in those two states as a result of hunts. More recently, the Fish and Wildlife Service delisted wolves in Wyoming administratively, meaning they did it through the administrative procedures of the Endangered Species Act. And we and a handful of other groups are in court challenging that. And right now, the Fish and Wildlife Service is delisting wolves everywhere else in the United States, with the exception of the Mexican gray wolf population in New Mexico and Arizona. So if you've heard rumors about a war on wolves, I can promise you they are real. There is not only these atrocious hunts that are occurring in Idaho and Montana and Wyoming, and as you noted, in Michigan, in Minnesota, but at the same time that the states are kind of cutting loose the guns and the traps on wolves, the federal government is abandoning wolves and trying to delist them literally in every other state in the United States. And that means that wolves will very likely not exist in states like Colorado and Utah and in landscapes that need wolves. I'll say just one more thing, Derek, which is one of the things that we broadly in the scientific community specifically have learned as a result of bringing wolves back to Yellowstone National Park is that wolves are an essential part of an ecosystem, and wolves make ecosystems more resilient, more healthy, more diverse, and it's because they are, I guess I'd say, they're ecological heavyweights. They, by being on the landscape, there is an ecology of fear that influences elk and deer and coyotes and just to continue with this, there's a cascade of effects. So the elk graze for shorter periods of time, especially along stream corridors. That has meant in Yellowstone that the cottonwood and willows that grow along streams have come back. That has meant the return of beavers who've built dams, who've created better habitat for waterfowl and trout, and it's meant more songbirds in the riparian, the cottonwood and willow woodlands that have come back. And it's been, I think, just an amazing thing to see the rebirth of the landscape and the presence of wolves. And it's sad that at the same time we've seen that rebirth, we've had this renewal of violence and hatred towards these not only beautiful and charismatic animals, but as I said, these are ecologically, these are just incredibly important actors on the landscape.
So it's we can talk about this if you want, or we can continue talking about important actors on the landscape. But I'm just reminded of, there's a friend of mine is from India, and is an environmental activist over there. And recently, the government has been putting forward some restrictions, has been making some tiger preserves. And it's a very complicated issue because, as often happens with restrictions, the corporations still get to do what they want, while the smaller people are often bear some of the brunt of that. So my point is that there are actually riots and people getting killed and over the hatred of the tigers. There are people insisting, you know, if you like forests, then you must hate people. And there's this, we can talk about this if you want, there's this extraordinary hatred in this culture of predators.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything you want to say about that, or do you want to go on to talk about prairie dogs?
Well, I mean, I think I would like to dwell on this, and I'm curious to hear more of your thoughts too. I'm saddened by it. I'm not so much puzzled by it, because I think when you tap in an innate fear that is both rational and irrational, and you meld that to what I see in the United States, which is greater economic uncertainty in rural communities, there is a part of me that can empathize with people that feel insecurity. What I can't empathize with, and I find intolerable, is victimizing the voiceless. And that's what I think is happening, whether it's the scenario you described in India or the one that is going on as we speak in Montana or Idaho, where a very, very small number of people, largely from rural communities, are hunting and trapping wolves in cold blood. And the fear piece is irrational. I mean, there's the little Red Riding Hood myth that it's out there, and myths have their meaning and resonance. None of it is rational when it comes to wolves. So I guess I'm discouraged, saddened, frustrated, angered by it all. And my only hope is that through the darkness and through all this blood that is being spilled, all across our countries, in terms of the hunting and trapping of wolves, that somehow, a stronger resistance movement will be born. It is being born. It is being manifest, and that it will create the political will ultimately, because it's our politicians in all the various in all their various forms that have allowed this to happen, and only we can change that. So difficult, dark days for wolves, sadly, but it's where we are at the moment in the history of trying to conserve these really, really beautiful, incredible animals.
There was an article last spring, and I thought of it again. I wrote something about this at the time, and I just found what I wrote, and it was kind of, the whole thing was for me really emblematic of the propaganda against wolves in many ways. It was an AP story called "Washington State Simmers Over Gray Wolves" was the headline. Mm-hmm. And the article was about this family, the McIrvin family, and the Diamond M Ranch in Washington, and how they'd suffered a grueling summer of losses, a quote, and the Sun was saying, we can't operate with the kind of losses we're seeing. And they claimed to have lost 12 cattle, killed or injured. And then when you did, and it was really, you know, oh my God, we're going to go out of business because we lost 12 cattle. But then when I did some research on it, it ends up that was 12 cattle killed or injured, and injured in this case actually included cattle that had run into barbed wire and not actually been injured, but just scratched. So they were really playing with that. But it gets even weirder, because only a couple of the wolves had actually, or a couple of the cattle had actually died, and they weren't even confirmed wolf kills. But here's the point, which is that Washington State pays ranchers for cattle killed by wolves. In fact, they get compensated twice market value.
Mm-hmm.
And so they could actually have profited from this, but the family wasn't making economic decisions on this. They just hate wolves, and they kept saying,
yes,
we have no interest in getting compensated for any of these cattle. And, you know, honestly, if I was running a business and I got compensated twice market value for every, you know, there's a lot of bears where I live, so if I got compensated twice market value for everything the bears do, mm-hmm. Like a friend of mine was parking at my mom's house the other day, and the bears were playing with his car, and they broke his windshield wiper. And so, you know, if he could just turn around and have the government pay him, you know, I don't know how much a windshield wiper costs, but pay him $20 instead of $10, you know, they could destroy my windshield wipers every day, and I wouldn't care.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It also ends up that this guy runs more than 5,000 cattle, and most of those are on public lands anyway. So a loss of 12 cattle, even if all 12 would have died out of 5,000, is just completely trivial.
Yeah.
But nobody talked about that. Instead, what they did is they called in snipers to kill the entire pack.
Yeah.
And we just hear that all the time. That's a far too typical story.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we stuck with this issue because it gets my blood boiling when you talk about the influence that ranchers have. You spoke to the kind of irrational hatred that drives their feelings about wolves. I wanted to touch on another thing that is, to me, a painful irony in all of this, which is you think of ranchers and the myth of John Wayne. What are the words that come to mind? To me, you think of the rugged individualist, the person who can take care of himself. And yet the painful irony is these ranchers are incredibly dependent on federal government support and handouts. They are what I would call kind of classic welfare queens. And why can't, especially given that they operate on public lands, why can't we have a standard and expectation that if you're going to graze on public lands, it's a privilege. And with that privilege comes the responsibility of coexisting with wolves and other native carnivores. And, oh, by the way, if you really are these rugged individualists that the cowboy is sort of made out to be, why can't you live up to that myth and take care of yourself and your cows out on the open range instead of crying for a federal handout every time that something goes wrong? I mean, if every business in our country operated in that way, we'd be in poor shape.
It gets my blood boiling too. And before we leave this topic and talk about prairie dogs, which I think is still going to make our blood boil more, one more thing, just for people, I don't think people who are not in the West might not know about public lands ranching. Can you give like a 20-second? How is that subsidized? What's the, how much do they pay versus what is the going rate?
Yeah, so about 270 million acres of Western public lands, national forests, and Bureau of Land Management lands are grazed.
And these are public lands. These are our lands. Yours are my lands.
Yep. You're on my land. Our names are on the deeds, just like everyone else's is. And these lands are permitted for use by various uses. Grazing is by far the most ubiquitous use of these lands, and the grazing fee that is charged is less than it would be for you to feed your pet hamster. It's a ridiculously low amount. That combined with very lax enforcement and oversight has resulted in not just subsidies, but this entrenched attitude that these ranchers sort of de facto control these lands when they don't. There are lands. So that's the context in which many of these wolf conflicts occur and other environmental conflicts in the West, that these are happening on our lands.
So once again, the wolves are not being shot because they killed cows. They didn't sneak into somebody's barn and kill their cows. They were, if they killed cows at all, they were killing cows on public lands, like in the National Forest or BLM.
Yep. Here's one just quick anecdote that is in the Gila Wilderness, and grazing is allowed in wilderness areas pursuant to a compromise under the 1964 Wilderness Act. If a rancher was grazing cattle and cattle were calving on the open range year-round, and so can you imagine a cow, mother cow, dropping a calf, not in a pen, not in a barn, not at one time of the year, but on the open range, unpenned, unfenced, it's not surprising that wolves would prey on those animals. And yet that sort of situation in New Mexico and Arizona has resulted in those wolves being killed and or removed. It boggles the mind. It boggles my mind that political reality, and that's what it is, is occurring in the 21st century. The landscape that has America's first wilderness, one of our most endangered mammals, and yet all the decisions flow to the benefit of the ranchers, not wildlife on our public lands. It's troubling.
Yeah. So now I want to go back to what you said about how the wolves are so important to, you know, when wolves go back onto the scene, when they re-inhabit a landscape, that benefits songbirds, it benefits beavers, it benefits cottonwoods. So another extremely important species who has also gotten completely hammered are prairie dogs. So can you talk about prairie dogs a little bit?
Sure. You know, I'll just say this about Wild Earth Guardians and our approach to conservation. And sometimes my staff gets frustrated about this because of this reality. But we try and focus on species that are highly interactive, as I mentioned earlier, these ecological heavyweights, because we want to get the biggest bang for our buck, and we want to have the most influence. And so one of the ways with our limited resources and size is to focus on the species that bring the greatest value to ecosystems. And by being keystones or indicators or umbrella species, that by performing any one of those roles, they can have value. So prairie dogs are ecological heavyweights because they're a keystone, and if you think of the keystone in the arch, you pull it out and the ecosystem falls apart, and that's exactly what has happened for prairie dog ecosystems all across the American West. I'm imagining that most of your listeners here have heard of black-footed ferrets, because black-footed ferrets were very popular, and they were kind of a totem for endangered species in the 70s and 80s at the time in our country when the Endangered Species Act was passed, and just a lot of popular support. It helps that they're very cute, cuddly, and charismatic. The only reason that black-footed ferrets are endangered is because they rely, I believe, 99% of their diet is prairie dogs. They are fierce carnivores, and they chow down on prairie dogs. And so there have been tens of millions of dollars spent on trying to recover black-footed ferrets without ever looking at the ferret as a symptom of the demise of the prairie dog ecosystem and prairie dogs in particular. And I view that as one of the great tragedies of modern conservation, that because it's not just about black-footed ferrets. There are burrowing owls that are dependent on prairie dog burrows and the whole colony of prairie dog burrows that are created. Mountain plovers, ferruginous hawks, even kit foxes, and they're about 30 to 40 snakes. Species that are directly associated and dependent upon prairie dog ecosystems, and upwards of 100 species that are, if not dependent, associated with and benefit from prairie dog burrows and the prairie dog ecosystem that the species create. So sadly, all five different species of prairie dogs are in trouble. One of them is listed, the Utah prairie dog. The other four species of prairie dogs, all of them are similar but slightly different. They're all in trouble. Wild Earth Guardians has petitioned to list all of these species under the Endangered Species Act. And unfortunately, the most recent federal action on prairie dogs was not a good one, because the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service decided not to provide federal protection under the act for the Gunnison's prairie dog. And the Gunnison's prairie dog is kind of the high mountain prairie dog that lives in the high mountains and valleys of New Mexico, Colorado, Utah, and Arizona, kind of a circle surrounding the Four Corners region. So we, I think today or maybe tomorrow, are going to be filing a notice of intent to sue the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service challenging that decision. And I'll tell you, there's one simple reason that we're going to challenge this decision. The Fish and Wildlife Service has taken this cynical approach that though prairie dogs, in this case the Gunnisons, are gone from 95% of their historic range, that where they exist in those few isolated pockets, they seem to be relatively okay. And while we may disagree with that latter point, it's the former point that, to me, is an outrage, and it, in a way, relates very much back to the wolf issue, which is, you know, if a species exists in only 5% of where it once existed, it's on the path to extinction, and that's there's this impression that the Endangered Species Act is just about preventing extinction, when really it's about ensuring the recovery of species, and that means that they've got to exist on far more than 5% of the range that they once existed. And but it's where we are today in terms of the way in which the Fish and Wildlife Service is administering the Endangered Species Act. They're taking this least resistance path, and where there are these politically charged species, whether it's wolves or in this case prairie dogs, they are sadly not siding on behalf of the species. And I guess the silver lining to the dark cloud in this instance is that it keeps us in business, because it's what we do. We are holding the federal government accountable to our environmental laws and making sure that they deliver on the promise of those laws, in this case to ensure that species not only go extinct, but those that are in peril benefit from the power that resides in the Endangered Species Act. So prairie dogs are struggling in lots of different landscapes all across the West, and the effort to turn that around has to be a part of that has to be winning in the federal courts and deploying the safety net that the Endangered Species Act provides.
A couple of things. One of them is that, and thank you for saying all that. That's really great. And one of the things is that, you know, we're talking about the hatred of the wolves, and it's, and what you said makes sense about including the fear, but that actually doesn't apply to the prairie dogs, because the prairie dogs aren't really scary, but they are certainly hated. And I know that in Kansas still, I don't know if it's true in other states, mm-hmm. I know in Kansas they actually have laws requiring that you kill prairie dogs if they're on your land.
Yeah.
And there are people who want to restore prairie in Kansas who have had the county supervisors or their employees come out at night and poison prairie dogs on private land.
Mm-hmm.
And it's... The hatred of prairie dogs is nothing. I grew up in eastern Colorado, and so we actually had some land that we grew hay on when I was a kid, and there was about 30 acres, and 10 acres we just didn't cut at all. There was prairie dogs on it. The point is we had prairie dogs on some of, quote, our, end quote, land, and I mean, I've loved them since I was a kid. You know, I write a lot about salmon, but that's because I live in the Northwest. And I think if I lived in the plains areas, I would be just as much in love with prairie dogs. They're just such cute, amazing little creatures.
Yeah.
But there's this incredible hatred of them, too.
Yeah. Well, just one thing I want to add to your, I guess, affection for prairie dogs, that so we have prairie dogs in Santa Fe, actually, even in the city of Santa Fe where I reside. And I would say that I didn't grow up with prairie dogs. I have come to love them for both kind of ethical, emotional, and scientific reasons. But in the latter category, and maybe in the first category, one of the things that I've learned that is incredibly fascinating about all species of prairie dogs is that they have distinct language.
Yep.
And that language, they have wonderful dialects. And there's a scientist out of Flagstaff by the name of Khan Slobachikov, who, that's a mouthful, who has been studying the language of prairie dogs for about a decade now. And he's basically found that, you know, they've got these dialects where the prairie dogs in Santa Fe speak slightly differently than the prairie dogs that exist around Flagstaff, though they both have a similar response to, say, the appearance of a red-tailed hawk in the sky above one of their colonies, or the appearance of a coyote on the edge of one of their colonies. So it, to me, invokes an ethical discussion about how we treat animals. And I know there's been a lot of discussion in the scientific community about this, and I think if you recognize and believe that animals have language and that they can communicate with one another, then it forces us to think, I think, a little more deeply about how, what's our obligation to them as human beings. But, you know, the hatred piece, I don't know how to overcome it. I know that hatred, frustration, and anger are not the recipe to, you know, you don't fight fire with it. And I think it gets back to maybe the mission statement in a way that I believe in compassion, and I believe that we need to be fierce in our defense of the voiceless. So I can stand someone in the eye and look them in the eye who is shooting prairie dogs for pleasure on a Saturday afternoon and express my sadness and at the same time, I'm going to court and I'm going in front of wildlife agencies to try and ban all hunting of prairie dogs because I think it's disgusting. And But the hatred is puzzling to me. I think it's born out of ignorance and it's born out of fear. And I don't mean fear from, as you described, they're cute, cuddly little creatures. What do we have to fear about prairie dogs? But there's some ignorance breeds fear that is irrational, and there's something there that is puzzling and beyond my ability to understand. But It's a large destructive force in the world, and I think we need to fight it, as I said, with both compassion and with fierce defense of these things that we love and care about.
That's great. That's great. I wanted to say one more thing that I know about prairie dogs, which is that they have, as you said, they have language, dialects, all that. And they also, and this shouldn't be surprising, they have best friends. You know, they're not just some, huge, huge prairie dog village where they're all amorphous. They have, you know, they might have one neighbor that they never spend any time with, another neighbor that they go over their burrow all the time. Anyway, so we have about 3 or 4 minutes left, and I really have two questions. So I don't know if we'll be able to cover them both. One of them is, you talked about the Fish and Wildlife Service, you know, having to sue them. And was it Ansel Adams? Who was it who said it's extraordinary that we have to sue the government to protect the earth? And especially the Fish and Wildlife Service, you know, you would think, just theoretically, you know, in some perfect world, that the Fish and Wildlife Service would actually act as advocates for the wild beings. And there are certainly, I know and work with a lot of people in fish and wildlife who are themselves wonderful advocates for wild beings. And yet there's this thing that happens institutionally where, And this happens in capitalism all the time, where a regulatory agency gets captured by the industry.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can handle that in like 10 seconds, then the other thing, or you can just ignore it. And the other thing is, and this is really what I want to end with, is so what do you want people to do with the information that you've given today? So if you can handle the first one, great. And if we don't have time, then we'll do it another time.
Yeah, maybe that one's suited for a bigger conversation, though I think the question of becoming captive to those you regulate is a tragic dynamic that is a big issue. In terms of what people can do, I would say it was some other person who noted that democracy is a full contact sport. And I, more than anything, want people to get up, stand up, and participate in democracy. I'm going down to a hearing tonight about Mexican wolves, and it's because I want my voice heard, and I want other people to know that I stand with them in solidarity and that I stand with wolves. And it feels good to do it when you speak up, and so I want people to know that Guardians is doing it. If you want to join our tribe, great. But join any tribe of people that is active and engaged in trying to envision the kind of world that we want to have. It doesn't happen without energy and passion and compassion. So to get engaged. We'd love to have you be a part of the Guardians tribe if it feels right. Give us a call. Check us out on our website. But that's really my secondary message. My primary one is find your place, your group, your issue, and stand up and stay at it. None of this stuff happens overnight. You got to have fortitude and passion to be in it for the long haul.
And it can be so scary. I don't know if you remember the first few times you got up to speak at public meetings. I was so scared and I was shaking. And I see this with young people too a lot of times. But you do it and then you go sit down and there are, you know, the other people around you are, you know, all the people up on the podium can be just giving you the evil eye, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one of the first times I ever spoke, James McClure was a senator from Idaho. It was just horrible. And one of the things I said to him is, I plan on seeing you in the dock for crimes against nature because of the horrible things you're doing. And I was terrified to say that. And, of course, he died before that ever happened. But I was terrified. But then I sat down, and the people around me gave me the courage to say that again.
Yes. Yes. No, that's beautiful. I still get a little nervous anytime I speak, even though I've done it hundreds of times, but I think that's, that's just goes as part and parcel of speaking out. But I think what you said is really true, too, that you draw strength from being in the presence of colleagues and allies. And, it feels good. Being pushing yourself feels good. So get out and get involved.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you for listening, and this is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. Thank you so much. Thank you, John Horning.
Hey, thank you. Bye-bye. Bye.